This podcast has ended and is no longer being updated. The company, Yizzy Research, no longer exists, nor does the coaching program or website. Please disregard any mention of these. You're listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, hosted and created by me, Imani, a researcher. This is the podcast for people who research people. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Chloe Markley.
I'm Chloe. I am currently the UX Research Director at EchoUser, and I'm responsible for managing and developing our team of researchers, managing clients, business development, and also from time to time, I get to jump in and actually work on research projects for our clients, depending on demand. I started my career as an in-house researcher, first at Oracle and then at Athena Health. And then I made the switch to UX consulting about 7 years ago. I joined GfK, which was then bought by Ipsos. They were a very large consulting firm. And then I ended up making the switch over to EchoUser. And we're a much smaller firm, kind of a boutique UX research and design agency.
Chloe will be sharing some tips and best practices for recruiting high quality research participants. And over the course of your career, you've spent years as a researcher recruiting people for various studies. How has recruitment changed from the beginning of your career up until this point now?
Sure. Recruiting has changed, I think, in a few ways. I mean, first when I started out, right, research ops really wasn't a thing. So that's, I think, clearly made a big impact for researchers and what we do. Having the support of research ops is really wonderful. But of course, not everyone is a place where research ops is happening. I also think a change from when I first started out is the majority of our research was done actually in person. So I think that to some extent changes the dynamics of recruiting, because you're only looking in your specific geographic area. You know, there's more logistics that you need to communicate through the process of recruiting. I would say now, in my experience, the majority of the research that we conduct is actually done remotely. And I think that that's sort of a great outcome of perhaps a terrible situation through COVID. But, you know, we're able to get like a wider group of participants. And I think that just diversifies the quality of research, which is great. And I think also the tools are so much better. Like back in Oracle days, we were using WebEx. It was terrible. You know, it was very hard for participants to download and use the tool. And now the level of people's experience with remote meeting tools and the quality of those tools is just so much better. I think there is another difference, not so much from when I first started, but thinking about different recruiting for different companies, right? From company to company, the processes might change, who you're recruiting might change, and there's different, that sort of has different flavors for how I might go about recruiting depending on those things. And that's not so much like over time of recruiting, just over the years of recruiting for different companies, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And as you mentioned, technology has made it so much easier to do research, especially remotely. But I've noticed that there's been an increase in bots and fraudulent participants. What do you think about this? Like, why do you think that is?
I have noticed this as well, Imani. It's very unfortunate, I guess, or it is what it is. I think there's been an increase in bots and fraudulent participants because I myself have experienced it. You know, I think that fraudulent participants to some extent has always existed. You know, they happened even in in-person studies. And that's why I think when we were at Oracle, we always checked participant identification and we managed a list of participants who had shown up and had been clearly fraudulent in the past and made sure that we didn't re-recruit those people. But I think that with remote research, with just the expanding of global connections, I think it's just a lot easier now to have people misrepresent themselves online. And I think now with AI tools, right, that has actually increased their ability to easily misrepresent, right? It doesn't take as much work to misrepresent yourself. You can get answers to certain things very quickly. And so I think there's more incentive in that case for them to be fraudulent because it's not as much effort and they can, you know, maybe do that a lot. But yeah, in a recent study, it became clear that the people who were responding, you know, were from other countries, where I was looking particularly for people in the United States. That just feels easier for people to find a survey online and respond to it regardless of their location. And in a recent experience, I received like more than 500 responses to a screener survey. And at initial first glance, I was like, oh, this is great, right? I'm getting so much response. But as I went through the process of screening, I realized maybe two or three of those responses were actually real participants, which was just super disappointing and time consuming.
You mentioned earlier in your career that people would, that there would be fake participants when you were still doing more of your research in person. And I think that's very bold of someone to show up in person, to know that you're committing low-level fraud. It's very weird and very bold of them to do that in person. That's funny. And I think an important part of all of this to filter through these low-quality people is screening. What questions should you include in a screener to filter out those types of people?
You know, this part I think hasn't changed, right? I think the rule of thumb, right, is to at some level try to obfuscate who you're looking for, right? To some extent, not making it super clear that you're looking for, you know, a participant who uses this device and this app or whatever it is. But I think that there's a few lessons that I've picked up now going through this process. One, maybe, and this, none of these unfortunately are foolproof solutions, but I think they'll help us improve our recruiting and the responses that we're getting back. One is not to necessarily end the survey if the person has quote unquote got the wrong answer, because I think that immediately makes them realize like, oh, I didn't, right? Obviously, I didn't get the right answer. I'm going to go back and fill this out again. Maybe, you know, and to some extent with a screening survey, you might be able to not allow multiple responses. But I think what I've noticed is people have spoofed a whole bunch of Gmail addresses, it seems like, as an example. And so they can go in and fill it out a bunch of times. So that's one way, especially maybe when you're looking for more of a general population, is just to let them fill out the survey. And then you're going in and, you know, doing some filtering or something to determine, this is what I'm looking for. This person is not what I'm looking for. I think in the past, I used qualitative questions to try not to necessarily weed out fraudulent people, though there was maybe an element of that, but more to let me understand, you know, how eloquent is this person? Are they clear in their thinking and that sort of thing? And that is no longer super helpful because, again, in this past experience, they clearly use ChatGPT. And so that's going to make someone sound like, you know, maybe somewhat clear or eloquent. And so that's no longer perhaps that helpful. Yeah, I think, let's see, I guess those are sort of my main points about screening.
Regardless of how precise your screener is, at least for me, and I'm sure a lot of researchers can relate, it always seems like there's either someone who is a sincere applicant but not a good fit, or someone who's fraudulent that answers the screener correctly. They game the screener, or they give us the right answers. What are some red flags to identify them at that point if they've made it into the session?
I always think that this is a little bit of a delicate situation because I personally don't necessarily feel great about telling, like, you know, making them feel like, oh, hey, you're not right for this, or there's something wrong with you, right? And I think I have in the past perhaps faked a situation where, oh, you know, some technological glitch, right? The prototype's not working. We're not recording, so we can't continue the session. Basically, to sort of cut our losses and say, hey, we're not going to, sorry, not actually say it, but make the, you know, make the decision to not essentially waste our time with this participant who we don't think is going to offer us the insights that we need. I would sort of use that as a way, you know, to cut the session off. But I think it's important to recognize that you were the one who sort of at the end of the day was at fault here, right? So I always think it's important to honor those participants and to pay them and make sure that they are thanked, even if they weren't, you know, the best fit for the research. So I think that that's kind of important to note. Some initial red flags. This is a small example. This may not be that helpful, perhaps moving forward, but I did notice in this screener I constructed, I had left open-ended questions for people to optionally fill in a gender response and an ethnicity response. So as a way to allow someone in this day and age, if they want to self-identify, allow for that. What was interesting, I noticed that people who are clearly fraudulent would automatically fill everything in the screener, not just like the, you know, not just select the answer, but fill in all of the optional things and then put slightly odd things in there. So, you know, one participant for gender said that he was male, but then put in heterosexual in this like optional box. And it was like, oh yeah, that's a weird way of answering that. This, you know, so I think there's like maybe minor red flags, but that you can look at from like the screening survey point of view. But at the end of the day, I highly recommend a screening call. I almost think that is almost a requirement before you're inviting a participant to participate in certain situations, right? If you're screening your customers, that's just a different thing because you generally know that they are your customers and maybe there's something else you're doing. Maybe you are doing a screening call, but if you're looking more for a general population where these people are pretty unknown, then you've got to talk to them before you invite them to your research.
But screening can be so awkward. I know you and I talked offline and we talked about how we're naturally trusting people and we want to trust that people say that if they're John Doe, then they're John Doe. If that's Jane Doe, that's Jane Doe. Again, very awkward. What are some reasonable ways for researchers to ask participants to verify their identities?
Yes, I am with you, Imani. I think I do want to trust that these people are real. However, I think you, on the other side of things, I think you have to keep yourself maybe bounded by the fact that you are doing this research for a purpose and you want to make sure that the quality of research that you produce as good as possible, right? The outcome is as reliable as possible. And so I think that can help maybe keep you a little bit balanced in terms of feeling bad about that, of like, okay, maybe I'm going to not trust you, participant, and try to figure this out with the fact that I want to make sure that you're going to provide me good data so that I feel good about my research on the outcome of it. So I have to say I have not personally done this a whole lot, but I do think it could be very valid to ask someone to ask them to show you their ID. And you know, if you're doing a screening call via video chat platform, have them hold that up and just verify. And it's possible that, you know, I would tell people up front, right, when you email them to invite them to the screening call, hey, I'm going to ask you just to verify your ID, make sure you have your ID at the session or something. And so that might weed out people initially, right? If they think that, oh, I've got to do this and I'm I'm scamming this person, they're just not going to respond to you. So that perhaps even saves you some time prior to actually conducting the screening call. Another thing I was thinking about that we use is, I think it's very valid, depending on the population, ask for their LinkedIn profile, right? I don't know how easy it is to spoof a LinkedIn profile, and perhaps in the future that might get more easy or something. But I think, again, if you're looking for people with certain, you know, in a business context for certain qualifications, that's something to look at. And it seems very non-threatening, I guess, in a way.
If you are an aspiring or current UX researcher who needs help with your resume, professional brand, interview skills, cover letter, LinkedIn profile, and portfolio, consider applying for the Yizzy Research Coaching Program. Coaching clients exit the program with a refreshed resume, cover letter, research portfolio, and detailed notes to make them more competitive in the UX research job market. If you are interested or know someone who is, visit yizzyresearch.com to learn more and apply. That's Yizzy Research, Y-Z-Z-I, research.com. Yeah, I'm imagining like asking a participant like via Zoom to hold up their ID to the camera. I don't know if you've seen the movie poster for Ace Ventura, Pet Detective with Jim Carrey, and he's holding up his ID or his card to the camera. Yeah, that's what it kind of reminds me of. It's really funny to think about. But yeah, it is true that you do have to have these different ways to verify people's identities. And also doing screener calls are important as well. And when should you do a screener call?
Again, there is an element of it will depend on who you're recruiting. Potentially, if you're recruiting your own customers, maybe this doesn't make sense because you can validate that they're your customers, and hopefully you have other ways of validating their experience or things like that. But again, in the general population, I would almost always recommend, because it, at the end of the day, while it does take a bit of your time, you're really just, it's more about coordination, and you're really just asking these folks for 5 minutes of their time. And I think this will also help you determine, you know, does this person generally make sense when I'm talking to them, right? Like, are they clear? Even if it's beyond just being fraudulent, it's sometimes helpful when you can weed out those people who are going to give you one word answers. And at the end of the day, you've taken whatever time the research is and you didn't really get that much out of them. So you can kind of gauge that during these calls. I really think there's a level of gut trust here. Just, you know, trusting, you're having a conversation with this person. Do they seem valid? Do they seem trustworthy? Or do they just give you a little bit of a shady feeling of like, oh no, this person clearly doesn't know what they're talking about, or they're really not they really don't know that much about the thing that I want to interview them about. And so you can really make that determination as you speak with them. Highly recommend, because this I've trapped, gotten myself trapped by this. Don't make the decision on that call, on that screening call, whether or not you're going to invite them, and don't promise them anything. Just say, hey, thank you for your time. I really appreciate you filling out these questions. I'm going to follow up with you about scheduling this session. And that way you can walk away from it and make a better decision that's not so quick on your feet. Because I've gotten trapped into inviting a fraudulent participant and then realizing during the session that they were fraudulent. So,
what questions are you asking a potential participant when doing a screener phone call?
Prior to conducting the screener phone call or the screening call, come up with a little bit of a script, just a few questions. Again, I think they're more qualitative questions, but have them expand on details that you've already asked them about. Because that there's an element of almost like double checking, like you put, you know, and don't tell them you put this in the survey, and you know, but like it's doing that, you know, it's at, tell me more about X, Y, and Z, and then sort of match that up with the answers that they put in the screening survey. So that, is their story consistent? And I think, you know, for instance, like if you're going to interview someone about a particular like app that they use or something, right, have them talk in more, give me an example of how you've used this thing, and just, and then just get them talking. And that's really where I think you're going to have that become clear. Do they actually use this thing? Do they seem to know about it? You know, I also think giving yourself a little bit of a ramp on this, right? After you conduct two or three screening calls, you've got that sense for what you're looking for, what you want, what you're expecting these participants to tell you. And that helps you make those gut decisions quicker. But the first two or three, I think, can sometimes be like, oh, you know, you're just ramping up a little bit, I feel like.
Yeah, those are all great points. I had shared with you offline that I was working on a research project in the past, and I was working with a research partner, and we were interviewing people who were veterans, or they were supposed to be veterans, or family members of veterans. And we were talking with someone, asking him, what branch of military did you serve in? And he couldn't respond. Then we heard a long pause, and we heard typing. And then we got a response, Navy, quite suddenly and abruptly. Then we asked some follow-up questions, and it was clear this person was not in the Navy or any other part of the military. So yes, that is important, doing that screening. And it can be awkward. And I like how you handled it with just not making a decision in the moment with them, but let's tell them you'll follow up. You'll send an update. That's a really diplomatic way to go about it as well. And I'm always thinking about how much time to spend on screening, especially if you're on a tight timeline. How much time do you recommend researchers spend on screening?
I don't know that I have to admit, I don't know that I have a great answer to this, because I think so much depends on the quality of participants that are coming in, and maybe how many people are potentially being fraudulent. This is going to sound trite, I suppose, but I feel like it always is going to take you longer than you think it does. I do think, again, these screening calls really should be short, you know, 5, maybe 10 minutes. You don't want to take too much of any person's time, I think, in this case. So, you know, defining a few blocks of a couple of hours where you're just going to knock some of these out is a good way to think about it. But in terms of like an actual gauge of time, I don't, you know, it could take anywhere from a couple hours to much longer than that.
That's fair. And it varies a lot from project to project, company to company. So yeah, that's great. So we talked about screening people, vetting them. Now, when you have your participants who are great, we love to reward them, of course, researchers. How do you determine how much to pay them?
Yes. How much to pay participants is a great, great question. Important thing to consider, of course. I think a general good rule of thumb is to consider how much expertise or training does someone have. And the, you know, the higher or more specialized they are, the higher the incentive to pay them. Much of my experience has generally been for recruiting medical and B2B. And so my internal gauge around this, or my bias around paying participants, I think tends to skew a bit higher. I have looked at, I know User Interviews has great tools for this. And I happen to look and sort of think that their estimates seemed a bit low to me. But again, I think I'm likely biased by what I have in my head over time of how I've paid participants. The other thing you do have to consider beyond how specialized people are, I think there's a difference, obviously, paying people for coming into in-person research versus remote, right? Remote, I think you can pay participants lower. They're just at their home. They don't have to get anywhere, travel, et cetera. I think there could be a difference if you are paying your customers or not. You may be able to, I don't mean it to sound this way, but you may be able to pay your customers somewhat less, given that hopefully they're going to, you know, they may be a little bit more of an engaged population. They are going to benefit, hopefully, from the improvements that your research will eventually bring. And non-customers may be harder to access. may be harder to attract, and you may need to pay them a little bit higher in order to recruit that population.
Mm-hmm. Also, a good rule of thumb I have found when working with more specialized populations was paying them whatever their hourly rate was, for like doctors, attorneys. So the incentive was pretty high for those types of studies. But yeah, I've heard that too, just as a point of reference. So let's say you're on a tight budget and you don't have money for an incentive. What are some non-monetary incentives?
Yes, I have experience with this, especially when I worked at Athena. Per company policy, it was considered a conflict of interest to pay participants, so we were not able to pay them. There's a few things that we did. One of the things is just try, and I'm sorry, this is not actually answering your question, but I will. We try to make our research more bite-sized. So a 30-minute, 40-minute session versus a 60-minute session to be more respectful of their time. I used to handwrite and mail thank you notes to our participants because I thought that was a really good way that for them to recognize that we really understood and appreciated their time and attention and participation. I think even if you are paying participants, a good practice is to email after a session and thank them for their time. Maybe, you know, including a sentence or two of, we're going to use your feedback to do X, Y, and Z, or it's helping us in this way. And that's just a very nice thing to do, I think. Again, they've spent your time with you. And so, and it's also a good relationship builder if you're, you know, potentially going to recruit from the same pool of participants over time. But to actually answer your question, I think swag, you know, if your company has any sort of swag with your company name, logo, or things like that, that is a good option if that's available to you. A low kind of cost token item, maybe it's a Starbucks gift card, maybe it's chocolates or something packaged very cutely or something like that, just to show that you really appreciate them.
Yeah, those are all really great ideas. I also think I feel like I've been a research participant for a nonprofit before, and they didn't have money to give, but they said that they could donate a portion of the donations they received to charity XYZ, which I thought was a really cool alternative as well. I've also heard of people responding saying that the incentive will be that our insights will be published for an audience of size XYZ to read. So those are some other cool incentives I've received as a result of being a participant. So those are some cool ones too.
I love those ideas.
Yeah, also I think for environmental organizations, I've heard of them planting a tree for every person they interview, which I thought was really cool. Yeah, you can get creative with these non-monetary incentives.
Yeah, absolutely.
And lastly, so you've managed throughout your career, you've managed and mentored researchers less senior than you. What format do you recommend for senior researchers who are training junior researchers in recruitment?
I think a apprenticeship model for training in this particular part of our craft is a really great way to do it. Making sure that every step of the way that junior researcher is involved, and even more so trying to let them take on pieces of it, right? Create this screener survey and then let's get together and talk about it, and help coach them through, maybe you need to word the question this way or things like that. Because at the end of the day, recruiting, I view recruiting very much as being really organized and on top of your timeline. And so it's the experience of going through it and knowing what you're looking for in terms of the participants that you're looking for too. So being really clear about that up front with the junior researcher, providing them with tools, I think is really, you know, tools and templates, right? So they're not creating a lot of this stuff from scratch. They can work from things. Obviously that's just best practice anyways, but they can work from templates, modify them to work for this recruit and move forward. And then you're sort of reviewing things with them, coaching them through it, and suggesting potential improvements. I also just think it's important as you're going across this sort of apprenticeship model to be checking in really often. Like maybe it's you're checking in every morning or something, right? Or maybe it's twice a day even, because I think the thing with recruiting is your time ends up flying by so fast. And sometimes you need to be on top of the moment to pivot when you're not finding enough people in this cohort or whatever it is, right? You have to be making quick decisions. And so being very collaborative and communicative across that process is important.
And a lot of practice. Practice makes perfect.
Yes, absolutely. Every new recruit, you'll get a little bit better at it. You'll learn a new technique, or you'll see a new fraudulent thing and then like remember for the next time, oh, I should, include this question or what have you. So
thanks for listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, the podcast for people who research people. I'm Imani, the host and creator. Visit yizzyresearch.com for podcast show notes and information about my UX research coaching program. Again, that's yizzyresearch.com, YZZI research.com. This podcast was produced by Whisper and Mutter.